Greetings, Race community. Brent coming in live with today's guest, Matt Termolin, who serves as Vice President for Institute Advancement at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, also known as RPI, the first STEM institution in the country. Welcome, Matt.
Great. Thank you, Brent. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I usually start these episodes by saying something like, Matt, I want to learn about your journey. So take me back to junior year of high school. Who was that guy? What was he into at Evanston Township High School? And what led you to Miami University? But I'm not going to do that right now.
Great.
Because you're a second generation fundraiser. So I actually want to know your first exposure to advancement that you can remember.
First exposure, I think was at the dining room table and talking with my father and his explaining. So my father started his career at Hope College, where he graduated, and then he was an AVP at SMU for 8 years. We lived down in Dallas, and then we moved to Chicago, and he became the VP for marketing and development at the Art Institute of Chicago. Oh, I just remember the dining room table, probably middle school. So we were in Chicago and talking about what he did. And that certainly piqued my interest. I can't say I acted on it much at that point, but, knew what he did, knew the importance of it. And really, I think, hammered home for me kind of this career opportunity in the nonprofit world and an opportunity to make an impact.
All right. So now take me to junior year of high school. Who was that, Matt? What was he into? And what led you to Miami University in Ohio?
Yeah, so that Matt was absolutely obsessed with airplanes. I ended up in high school getting my pilot's license.
Whoa.
I actually ended up at Miami in part because they had a very good naval ROTC program. And I got a 2-year scholarship. So many people know the ROTC does 4. So this would have been 83. They did 2-year scholarships. So I spent my freshman, sophomore year as a midshipman there, but realized that I was more interested in service to the country as opposed to necessarily service in the Navy. Upon graduating from Miami of Ohio, was looking for that opportunity to serve and join the Peace Corps.
I saw not only did you join the Peace Corps, but you specialized in beekeeping in Honduras, which I want to talk more about. But before we do, tell me more about being a high school kid with a pilot's license. That is amazing.
Yeah, it was just a great experience. And I love my parents were just amazing for supporting me doing that. I did cut a lot of lawns to help pay for it. It's not a cheap enterprise, but it was something that I just always dreamed of. And
were there any tell me just about like during that process, were there any just like moments you'll never forget? Like
absolutely. I think for everyone, it's that first time the first time going up, right, on a lesson, really when the instructor pilot says you have it right and you're at control of the aircraft, that's great. I think the first time doing stalls in the aircraft, right? So we would go out kind of northwest of Chicago where there wasn't much air traffic and, practice all the maneuvers you practice. And certainly I think the first time I flew solo was one of those moments I think for most people who go into flying will never forget, right? The opportunity to, when that instructor gets out of the plane and says, I know you can do it, go take her around. I remember that day really well and just loved it.
Amazing. Is it a part of your life at all today?
Not much. I've started, we have 3 sons, all now out of college and all launched professionally. And I'll tell you a little something because 2 of them have gone into advancement and I didn't put that in the in the questionnaire, but I've kind of slipped back into it now that I have a little more time, hoping to reactivate my pilot's license here in the next year.
Wow, very, very cool. I love it. All right, so now take me to Honduras. I mean, what an adventure. It's the just to set a little bit of context, I think we're talking late 80s here.
Yeah,
and go to the Peace Corps. What's the onboarding process to that career path look like?
Very interesting. And I'll give a, I think Peace Corps does a very good job of it. So what Peace Corps does is, you know, I don't think most people realize they're really looking for technical expertise. And so I was a political science major coming out of Miami. They offered fish farming or beekeeping. I chose beekeeping because I thought candidly it sounded a little more exotic. So I spent 2 months in South Carolina training in beekeeping. So there were a group of Peace Corps volunteers. We were being taught by another Peace Corps volunteer who had been doing it for years. And we spent 8 weeks in Frogmore, South Carolina, learning all about beekeeping and extension work. We then flew down to Honduras. We were incorporated into another group of Peace Corps volunteers, and it included engineers, teachers, forestry. And we spent 3 months doing language training and then getting some additional technical training. And then come January 1st of 1988, I was assigned to the Honduran Ministry of Natural Resources as a beekeeping extension agent.
So, I mean, between a pilot's license in high school and beekeeping in Central America, I mean, you're not a shying away from adventurous experiences. Like what stands out? What are some of the key memories from that period?
You know, I think, you know, at end of the day, I think most Peace Corps volunteers would say this. I'd certainly say it. I think it was an amazing experience. The Honduran people, you can't imagine nicer, warmer, thoughtful people. I was so welcome into Honduras. And I think, you know, the memories that stand out are A, the people I worked with in the Ministry of Natural Resources, wonderful colleagues. And then, of course, the impact that you made. I still, to this day, stay in touch with a number of beekeepers in Honduras. And, you know, and I worked with anything from women's group to a high school to larger, more commercial beekeepers. And this was the advent of the Africanized bee or the killer bee. So we're helping them manage this new type of honeybees. So I think at the end of the day, it's knowing that you made a difference. You know, it may not have been as big as you initially thought you might make, but knowing that you really helped impact people, made their lives better.
So what's one thing everybody listening should know about beekeeping, but probably they don't?
Let's see. That's a great question. The bees don't know you. So I get asked that question a lot. Do the bees know you? They do not know you. They are very productive insects, but they have no idea who the owner is. So there's lots of lore about that.
Got it. Okay, not building a rapport over time. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. So help me understand then the path into advancement.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, coming out of the Peace Corps, I looked at a range of opportunities. I had done some training for the Peace Corps, so I had an opportunity to stay in Honduras. I had an opportunity to work with an American company that was working in Honduras. I looked at a banking program within the U.S. and was accepted into that. But back to my father said, you know, you really enjoyed the impact of the Peace Corps. You're a good writer, strong communicator. You should think about going into fundraising. And I met with, I remember going to the University of Chicago for a friend of my father's complete, you know, just informational interview. And walked out an hour later thinking, this is what I wanted to do. And
what was it about that conversation? Because you had plenty of exposure to the field by way of your father. What inspired you in that meeting?
You know, what inspired me was, again, what I think I'd been searching for since the Peace Corps was how to make a difference. And how am I spending my days? Am I making society a better place? I think I really, Brent, came away feeling that higher education and education in general has probably the greatest opportunity to change our society. And so spending this hour with Randy Holgate, she was the associate VP at University of Chicago. She became the vice president, now retired. I realized that I could make that kind of impact doing this kind of work. And it's not that I didn't see it with my father, but this, you know, I think sometimes hearing it from a different person, seeing it in a different lens, really kind of crystallized everything for me.
And so you joined the University of Chicago.
Yep. Yeah. Joined the University of Chicago as an assistant director in annual giving.
And so what was a day in the life of an assistant director of annual giving?
Well, it was, so I managed reunion classes, class agents, and, you know, some general projects for the office. I loved it. I mean, I inherited I think it was 20 different class agents and 4 reunion classes. And this is all just to age myself, pre-internet, this was even before faxes, right? So, you know, when we would work on reunion letters or class agent correspondence, we did it snail mail through the phone. You know, I would typically have a chance to meet with, you know, University of Chicago. Obviously, many alumni are in the Chicago area. So I would meet with many of the alums. And, you know, it was a great way to learn the business, everything from making the ask to working with volunteers to understanding the role of planned giving, major gifts, and alumni engagement.
And did you have additional stops prior to Northwestern or?
I did. Yeah, no. So I was lucky. It was one of those things, kind of right place at the right time. I ended up becoming the associate director. And then I was the director of annual giving at University of Chicago. So I ran their central annual fund. And then I moved into their major gift office. You know, I knew as director of annual giving, I had only done annual giving, that it was time to kind of broaden my skill set. And so I covered the Southeast territory. So it was kind of Atlanta, parts of North Carolina, but really a focus on Florida, and really learned a lot there. So I felt that that helped round out my skill set, made me a good candidate to go to Northwestern as their assistant dean for arts and sciences.
Any memorable, like particularly memorable visits or trips, whether they were really excellent or, you know, complete disasters from a travel perspective? I mean, what
right.
are some of the memories? Yeah.
Well, I could tell you, you know, story, we've all had these, you know, the fire alarm at 3 in the morning, right, at your hotel, and you're standing outside. But I think probably the most memorable at the University of Chicago is I got to know an alum. His name is Jay Berwanger. And Jay played football at University of Chicago. And I many of your listeners probably don't know that University of Chicago, I think, used to be part of the Big Ten, still, I think, is either 4th or 5th in the Big Ten in terms of Big Ten titles that they've won for football. Jay was the first winner of the Heisman Trophy. And he brought it to campus. As a matter of fact, I think he donated it to the university later on. But he told me this wonderful story. The Heisman Trophy wasn't as big of a deal when he first won it. Obviously, it's increased in prestige over the last, certainly, 30, 40 years or more. But he told me this wonderful story of how he used this Heisman Trophy in his garage as a doorstop. So
amazing.
True story, and an amazing person.
I grew up about an hour north of Jay. Jay grew up in Dubuque, Iowa, and I grew up near Decorah and football. And that is a very fun story. And yeah, the just keep it in the garage. Things
yep.
have evolved.
Exactly.
And so tell me about making the move to Northwestern.
Yeah, the move to Northwestern, I think, was really driven a couple ways. One is, you know, I always wanted to consider, I wouldn't say have, but I always wanted to be considered for kind of a leadership role, right? AVP or VP role in my career. And when Northwestern came, I have family connections. I have a brother who went to law school. My mother went to the music school at Northwestern. And I was approached as I said, the assistant dean for arts and sciences. And I think Brent, what really attracted me there was it was an opportunity to get to add another skill set. I thought, okay, well, I've managed a big team. I've run volunteers. I've led the annual fund. I've done major gifts. Here's an opportunity to really immerse myself closer to the academic enterprise. And so I moved into that role and really enjoyed supporting a dean in a campaign. We received a naming gift at that time for the College of Arts and Sciences. All those things, family, opportunity, all came together at the right time. I'd also be remiss if I didn't say it was also, I was commuting from Evanston to Hyde Park every day, which was about an hour 15 minutes. And the development office for Northwestern was about a 5-minute drive from my house. And we had little kids at the time. So it was also a big lifestyle change, but really driven by the professional aspects.
Hey, when the professional and the personal line up better, that's what it's all about when it works out, right?
Yep, absolutely.
And so you had an amazing run there. It was a big part of your childhood, and you raised your family there. And so making the move to Syracuse, I mean, that's a huge move.
Oh, yeah.
Was it hard?
It was. I'd been at Northwestern for 17 years, loved every minute of it, had been an AVP for 11, and had been approached for other VP jobs, wasn't ready, family wasn't ready, or didn't feel like the right fit. And when Syracuse came, it felt like the right fit. I felt like I was ready. Moving the family was hard, but two of our kids were in college already. It was probably toughest on our youngest son, who was just finishing up his sophomore year in high school. Never easy to pick up and move like that. But I saw in Syracuse a great opportunity to build a wonderful team. They had just had changed chancellors, so they had a new chancellor, Kent Severud, who's there currently. And so it was an opportunity to really build a team lead the university into a campaign. So, but difficult nonetheless. Hard to pick up family. I have other family in Chicago. Also hard to leave a great institution.
And tell me about the transition into the top spot. Like, if you could go back and talk to that Matt, what would you advise him on based on the experience?
Boy, based on the experience, A, you can't do everything. B, surround yourself with good people. C, know your strengths, right? Know what you're good at, know what you're not good at. I think those are all important things to do. I think I was aware of those stepping into that role. So, but I think, now in my second VP job, I think you kind of learn a little bit more, certainly at Syracuse and now at RPI, kind of, where you're going to make the most impact. I think I had good experiences at Northwestern working with the board. So I think focusing on the board, making sure you understand your CEO's priorities, all of those things, I think, are key things. I don't think I had too many missteps. I think, none of us are perfect, of course. I think, maybe trying to do too much too fast might have been one of the biggest challenges I had.
Tell me more about the board relationship, because I think we, see your seat and it's a lot of building the team and managing, but there's also managing up. And just tell me about that dynamic and sort of what the ideal relationship is based on your experience.
Oh, absolutely. So I think, I think managing up, first off is understanding just your board chair, right? The board leadership. Taking time to really get to expand on those relationships, I think is critical. One of the things I did both at Syracuse and RPI was to spend time with members of the advancement committee, to spend time with members of the board of trustees as a whole, and really understand kind of their perspective, their points of view. I think making sure, just as you have to be in lockstep with your president or chancellor, you have to be in lockstep with your board chair as well as with the chair for the advancement committee or your development committee, whatever it might be called. So that has to be pretty seamless in understanding what the priorities, where are they in terms of their thinking about advancement. I've been lucky because at both Syracuse and at RPI, the board's been very interested in investing in advancement and placing a greater emphasis on what advancement work does. So I feel like I've had wonderful partners at both places.
I always imagine a role like that at an institution like Syracuse or the others, and it just seems so overwhelming because you have hundreds of thousands of constituents, you've got a big team, then you've got the boards, then you've got deans and faculty, and it just feels like you could spend all day just meeting with people and getting to know new people and never get anything done. But then there's like the balance of how do you sort of do the networking and the relationship aspects and also carve out time for running the running the shop.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I think that's that is a challenge. It goes back to the earlier point I made about having a good team. And that's where I think knowing where you can make a difference. You know, I think making that move from an AVP to VP. One of the things somebody told me, which I thought was very helpful, is that the skill set you had as an AVP, you can build on that, but that may not always be the skill set you want to be using as a VP. So I realized that, I was good at both strategy and tactics. I kind of knew the division inside out when I was an AVP. And I realized that as a VP, you have to be very much more focused on the board of trustees, the president, your fellow members, your fellow VPs, I should say, but also the deans. There are going to be other things. You just have to have a good team and let them run the shop, right? And that means you're going to be maybe more at that 40, 50,000 foot level than you've been in other positions. And your tendency might be to reach deeper or to kind of fall back into your comfort zone, and you can't do that.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, especially like if you came up the ranks in annual giving, right? And then you moved into the major gift work. And so you've seen a lot of it. You've done, most of it in some capacity. And so I'm sure it's hard sometimes to, it's like, enough to be dangerous about a lot of things, which could be easy to want to dive in and get your hands dirty.
Brent, you hit the nail on the head. I think I used to say, once an annual fund officer, always an annual fund officer, right? And I wanted to start digging into retention rates and, all that kind of good stuff. And yeah, you have to build a great team, trust that team, let your senior staff go and hire really good people. And sure, if something's broken, you have to lean in, but you have to really be focused on where what somebody said, what are the things that only a VP can do, right? And what can't your AVPs do? So focus on the things that the VP can do.
Tell me, you've talked a lot about team and importance of building a team. You've clearly recruited and worked with many people, and I'm sure many have gone on to do other things. Who are some of the people you've really enjoyed? Not asking you to name a favorite or two, but just who are some of the people you've had the opportunity to work with, who you've enjoyed maintaining a relationship with?
Oh, absolutely. And it's been over the years, I'll say one of the things that I also think is incredibly important is having a good peer group, people around the business. When I was director of annual giving at University of Chicago, I was trying to reach out, find some peers, kind of understand what was working for them, what wasn't. And I reached out to the director of annual giving for the Hopkins Fund at the time, Fritz Schrader. Fritz is now the VP at Johns Hopkins. So I think I've known Fritz since since 93, 94. So going on 30 years. So I think that's one example. A couple more. I think, I was thrilled recently. David Lively was named VP at Northwestern. I was an AVP when we hired David into Northwestern, and we continue to share notes, stay in touch, talk. So that's really important. I give another example. I could keep on going, but Julie Allen, Julie was a work study student in the annual fund office at the University of Chicago when I was director of annual giving. Julie went on, did great things at University of Chicago, went to Duke University. Husband took a faculty job at Northwestern, and I was thrilled to be able to hire her as a campaign director at Kellogg School of Management when I was there. And, and she's been the AVP at Northwestern, just recently moved in as the VP and board secretary at Northwestern. So two examples from my Northwestern days.
I love it. Well, our listeners will know Fritz from episode 175 and David from episode 161. And Julie is now officially in our pipeline. So thank
you. All right. Well, great. No. And then certainly at Syracuse, we had a great team there. Sean Scanlon, Peter Cronin, Sue Ballard, Lynn Vanderhook, just Rachel Vassell. Of course, I'm going to forget somebody. Don't apologies in advance for that. But wonderful team, and many of them are still at Syracuse doing great things. Some have moved on other places. Some came with me here to RPI. So I think just investing in people is just such a critical part. And I won't say overlooked. I think we're pretty good at it, but I think we could do better as an industry.
Tell me about the move to RPI. You're kind of a year plus in. I mean, what are you excited about? And where do you go from here?
Yeah, well, I think, I'd always been at both Syracuse, Northwestern, University of Chicago, larger private research universities, a little more broad. What I was really intrigued by RPI was A, the leadership, so new president. Marty Schmidt had been the provost at MIT for many years. He's an RPI undergrad and PhD grad from MIT, spent his entire career at MIT, but he came to RPI, his alma mater, to become president and to lead RPI into its bicentennial year, which we're currently in. I think leadership really excited me. B, I think STEM schools have a special place right now in our country. As we all think about artificial intelligence, as we think about quantum computing, as we think about energy, as we think about carbon capture, I think this is a special moment, like I said, for technically oriented schools. Now, many universities have engineering and medicine and other parts in them, but I do think this is a special time for these types of institutions to make real societal impact.
Yeah, I mean, it is such an exciting period. It's late June as we're recording this in 2024. And it's sort of like, I don't know, I feel like we are talking about AI so much that on one hand, it's probably exhausting to people. And on the other hand, I feel like we're not even talking about it enough because it really is one of these like step function changes that I think in 5 years we'll look back on and realize how big of a moment was as it's been really integrated into applications in new ways. It's so early, but it's so exciting. And for you to be there, you've got even more of a front row seat to, I'm sure, the next generation. And I'd love to just kind of, and at the same time, your donors and some of your trustees, I'm sure that they're all trying to navigate what are the implications, their businesses, and sort of on one hand, disrupt themselves from a business perspective, but also it's an opportunity for RPI to like further strengthen its position in the education landscape.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's, and to your point, it just evolving at such a rapid way, right? So you talk about AI, well, AI where we are now, generative AI, right? Machine learning, there's just so much going on. And yes, I mean, many of our donors wrestle with it in their own professional worlds, but they also want us and RPI, but also us means U.S. higher education and the U.S. in general to be strong in this area. I've had a front row seat in the CHIPS Act, right? So as we try as a country to reshore chips manufacturing, that's another area. So I think all of those things kind of come together at a really important time. But the AI is just fascinating, to your point, to have kind of a front row seat at this point and see how this develops. I'm not an engineer by background, as I mentioned earlier, but I do think it's a benefit of a good liberal arts degree to be able to understand some of these concepts.
Well, we're very excited about the implications for advancement because I think that relative to many sectors, very few sectors have the kind of lifelong connection with their customers that advancement organizations do. And with a lifelong connection comes just a data set that is so rare relative to most brands, right? You and I exist in the CRMs of a whole bunch of different companies, every hotel we've stayed at, everything we've ever bought. But the amount of data and the authenticity of the connection to the university we studied at, for example, is so different and so rare. And I feel like that means that the potential for artificial intelligence is even greater because we have all this data that we can now synthesize that has before just sort of been locked away in tables of various systems. We can now make sense of that. But then we can look at all of that data and look at everything happening at RPI or at Brown or wherever and start to cross-reference everything happening out here with everything that this donor's ever told us and every gift they've ever made and every event that they've ever attended and the name of the event, and start to quickly, I think, triangulate on potential philanthropic opportunities that in past might have required just a ridiculous amount of manual hunting and pecking. And so it's not like it's just going to become, here's the button to go make your transformational gift, but I feel like we can just get people there much faster.
That's it's a massive opportunity for advancement, to your point, right? I mean, we all have CRMs in various states, right? Some state of the art, some are old and need upgrades or completely new CRMs. And so I think, again, to your point, that the data where it's locked right now, how we unleash that potential is one that I think we're starting to address. I think we've got a lot more ahead of us. And I say that in an exciting way. Like, I don't think I think it's a real opportunity, especially at this pivotal point for higher education. There's a lot of questioning right now about the value of higher education, about affordability of higher education, about the politicalization of higher education, right? So I think now more than ever, we need our alumni, our donors to lean in, and support the institutions that we represent.
You mentioned at the beginning that you felt like you were attracted to higher ed once you really understood the opportunity to make an impact, that that was something that mattered to you. And at the same time, you just highlighted that despite in our work every day, I'm sure you're being exposed to new stories of just life-changing outcomes, right? And you can witness philanthropy becoming an endowed fund kicking off a distribution, the distribution going to a student, and a student going on to do things they otherwise never could have. Like you live that, your peers live that, and it is so counter to the headlines that you were just describing. And so, like, how is it that we can both be making such a big, unequivocal impact, generating outcomes that otherwise simply could not happen, and be losing the PR battle the way that we are?
Yeah, wonderful question. I wish I knew the answer to that. Look, I think we have to be true to ourselves, true to our values, really look deep, if you will, and say, okay, how have we benefited in the past? How, the American higher education sector, I still believe, is preeminent in this world in terms of learning, research, dissemination of knowledge. So I think we have to be true to ourselves. I think we have to do a better job of sharing the work that we do, and really in particular how it impacts society. I think it's very quick for headlines to make news, or I should say, kind of, the press loves, kind of that story that catches kind of popular opinion. How do we turn that? How do we turn that in a way that really highlights all the great things that we do on a daily basis? So I wish I did. I don't think there's any silver bullet. I just think we have to be really true to ourselves.
But you, and I think there's also a balance of like, on one hand, we should be critical and we should constantly be trying to identify ways that we can be better and more efficient and more effective, but also at the same time, boldly proclaim the life-changing stories and the data that backs that up in a way that helps counter the narrative, and so that it's just not as one-sided. And we all got to keep doing that. I think it's a blend of data and anecdotes for sure, and that's the way that we got to motivate and inspire regardless of the topic. And I just think this is one where it just feels like the scales are out of balance relative to the good being done.
And I think, Brett, you mentioned the two things. Take your first. I do think it's a time for us to look in the mirror, right? And what can we do that's better? Are there ways that we can deliver education more in a more affordable manner? And are there ways that, I think many, I heard somebody describe degrees as kind of you need your degree just in case, and it's moving now to more only if needed kind of. And I don't, I do, like I said earlier, believe in the value of a degree, and as well as the residential program. So, but I do think it's a time for us to step back and really examine and not just take for granted what we've been doing for the last 50, 60 years.
Well, and I think that's where we have not yet really begun to see what the implications of generative AI are on education delivery. Because, I mean, look, I was driving my son, my 5-year-old, to his summer camp drop off yesterday morning, and he asked me one of those, why is the sky blue questions, Daddy? And I, I'm now like teaching him how to ask that question to ChatGPT. Give ChatGPT the context that this is a 5-year-old that's asking the question, and then have a conversation, sort of pulling on different threads, and just like the access to knowledge, like the amount that he can get exposure to. And then, oh, by the way, if you wanted that to be in a different language, I mean, imagine going and being a Honduran beekeeper, Peace Corps volunteer today relative to, whatever pocket dictionary you were carrying around. Like, it's just remarkable.
Oh, it is. It is. And that's what's so exciting about this time. And again, I think the role that higher education can play.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, tell me more about what you're excited about. I think you mentioned Bicentennial and a lot of team building going on. Just yeah, give me the state of affairs at RPI, what you're excited about, and for sure if you're hiring and how people can get in touch.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you, Brent. So it is our bicentennial. We're significantly growing. So we will launch a second phase of our campaign this coming September. And the campaign's tied to our bicentennial, obviously, a new strategic plan, Rensselaer Forward. I think there's Rensselaer. What surprised me, candidly, once I got here is the number of firsts. I mean, it's really a pretty amazing place. It's a very modest place, which is great. But sometimes we don't kind of share our successes. We just installed and it's up and running in April, the first quantum computer on any university campus. So that was installed in April. And I think that's just an example of some of the work that's going on here in campus. I had a meeting earlier today with our Dean of Engineering, and to hear him describe some of the work that they're doing in whether it's drones or robotics or advanced manufacturing, right? There's just some great things going on here. So it is, it sounds, you see ads, dynamic, growing, right? All those words used a lot. I think what's special about RPI right now is you can really make a difference. We're small enough team, we're nimble enough, we're willing to try new things. So we're looking for people who are creative, who are entrepreneurial, who we had been significantly shrunk over the years, the advancement office, so we're really growing. We have a lot of green fields out there, and so I think for those individuals who are who love this work, whether it's in alumni engagement, whether it's in annual giving or major gifts, there's just a tremendous opportunity Like I said, to be creative, to join a team. We're, we just had a team retreat yesterday. We use words like fun, and respect, and like entrepreneurial and sense of humor. Those are all things that are part of our lexicon here. I think we need more of that across the industry.
Well, if the words fun, respect, and entrepreneurial resonate with you, I'd encourage you to reach out to Matt. He's easy to find, certainly on LinkedIn and other platforms. But Matt, I want to just say thank you for your willingness to share your story. We covered a lot of ground, and I look forward to continuing to get to know you.
Great. Well, thank you, Brent, very much. Thanks for having me, and look forward to talking with you soon.
All
So,
right, maybe we'll see you at the Case Summit or something.
I will see you at the Case Summit next month.
All right, sounds great. So with that, I'm going to wrap today's episode with Matt Termolin, who serves as Vice President for Institute Advancement at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Thank you so much, Matt, and take care, everybody.